From Redeemer Broadcasting, this is Holding All Things Together for this third weekend in April. I'm Dan Elmendorf.
And I'm Calvin Carter. Today we look deeper into the rights of illegal immigrants with respect to deportation. Does such a person have due process rights? We find that deportation of illegal immigrants, when conducted according to established legal procedures, generally does not violate due process under U.S. law. The 5th and 14th Amendments guarantee due process, which applies to all persons in the U.S., regardless of immigration status. However, the scope of due process in immigration cases is narrower than in criminal cases because deportation is considered a civil, not criminal, proceeding. Our guest today is Hans von Spakovsky, Senior Legal Fellow in the Mies Center for Legal and Judicial Studies at Heritage and former member of the Federal Election Commission.
Yeah, one of the problems I see, in especially with folks in the media and people making these claims, is they're confusing constitutional due process rights that are due to criminal defendants and civil cases. Okay, and here's the way to, I think folks can easily understand that. Look, if the government's going to prosecute you in a criminal case, right, they're going to charge you with murder or assault or something like that, then yeah, you are due certain due process rights, whether you're an alien or a citizen. And that includes, the ability to be represented by counsel, the ability to take the Fifth Amendment, etc. But immigration cases, they're not criminal cases. They're civil cases.
Also ahead, Pastor Bill Shisko discusses how to flee the wrath of God. Later in the program, writer Jerry Wiss returns to Genesis, where we find Jacob ready to leave his uncle Laban in Haran to return to Canaan, the place God had designated for him and his growing family. Finally, we'll take another look at this week in history. All this just ahead on Holding All Things Together.
Well, we come to a new section of the Westminster Shorter Catechism as we've been dealing with sound doctrine according to this old and tried and true form of teaching. And the sections kind of break down this way. If you do questions 1 to 38 in the Westminster Shorter Catechism, well, what you're dealing with there is the doctrine of God, the doctrine of Christ, the doctrine of redemption in Christ. We were told when we were preparing for examinations for my licensure for the ministry, make sure you memorize Westminster Shorter Catechism 1 to 38, because those are the basic truths about God and his work in history. And then when you come to the next section, which is basically questions 39 to 84, the midsection of the Shorter Catechism, what does God require of us? And that's a large section on the Ten Commandments. And very important, if you stay in that section, you're going to be a moralist. You're going to try to do what you cannot do. You're going to try to get yourself up to heaven by the ladder of the law, and you're not going to be able to do it. And then significantly, there's a segue. Questions 82 and 83 and 84, is any man able perfectly to keep the commandments of God? And the answer is no one is. You can read the full answer in the Shorter Catechism. And then, are all transgressions of the law equally heinous or wicked? And the answer is no, they're not. You can read that. Some sins in themselves, and by reason of their several aggravations, are more heinous in the sight of God than others. And then question 84, this will blast your moralism. What does every sin deserve? Every sin deserves God's wrath and curse, both in this life and in that which is to come. Do you hear that message from your pulpits? If not, then your pastor is not being faithful to what the Word of God says. Now, when you come to question 85, notice the difference. What does God require of us? that we may escape his wrath and curse due to us for sin? That's the most important question facing everybody. The most important question is, how do you flee from the wrath of God due to us for sin? And here's the answer. To escape the wrath and curse of God due to us for sin, God requires of us faith in Jesus Christ, repentance unto life, with the diligent use of all the outward means whereby Christ communicates to us the benefits of redemption. We'll begin unpacking that next week. My question for you, are you fleeing from the wrath to come?
On the Zoom line with us today is Hans von Spakovsky from the Heritage Foundation. Hans, it's wonderful to have you back on with us today.
Well, thanks for inviting me back.
We have an interesting case legally in these United States regarding illegal aliens or immigrants that aren't supposed to be here, whatever the term is, and that is as regards to... Well, some people feel that they're not getting due process when they're being deported. I imagine with your background, you've thought through this. And is there any guidance that you could give us on this issue?
Yeah, one of the problems I see, especially with folks in the media and people making these claims, is that they're confusing constitutional due process rights that are due to criminal defendants and civil cases.
Yes.
Okay. And here's the way to, I think folks can easily understand that. Look, if the government's going to prosecute you in a criminal case, right, they're going to charge you with murder or assault or something like that, then yeah, you are due certain due process rights, whether you're an alien or a citizen. And that includes the ability to be represented by counsel, the ability to take the Fifth Amendment, et cetera. But immigration cases, they're not criminal cases.
Mm-hmm.
They're civil cases. And what the Supreme Court has said in these kind of immigration cases is, for example, if you're an alien outside of the country who is trying to get into the United States, you have no due process rights at all.
Mm-hmm.
The government can refuse you entry for no reason or any reason. And that's the subject of Supreme Court decisions that have said that. If you're in the country illegally, what the Supreme Court has said is, yeah, you are entitled to some due process rights, but it's not what the Constitution says that citizens are due. The due process rights that you are entitled to is what Congress gives you. And that means that you do have to have the opportunity to appear before an official so that you can at least present your case. But it doesn't have to be a court.
Oh.
It can be an immigration officer. It can be whatever Congress says will be okay for you. And you can see the difference, Dan, in the fact that, look, if you and I were arrested, right, by the FBI, what would they have to do? They have to read us our Miranda rights,
sure.
Correct? Okay. Well, if ICE detains and arrests an illegal alien, they don't have to read a Miranda rights because it's not a criminal case. It's a civil case.
Gotcha.
And Mr. Garcia, the El Salvadoran,
yeah,
they keep referring to as a Maryland father, he's a citizen of El Salvador. He already got all of his due process rights that he's entitled to under immigration law. How? He went through an immigration hearing. In fact, I think he went through two hearings. Immigration judges are not federal judges. They are employees of the Justice Department. And what Congress did with the whole immigration legal system it set up is they set up a process for illegal aliens to get a hearing before a federal immigration judge. Like I said, they're employees of the Justice Department. In fact, they work for the Attorney General. If that judge orders you to be deported, well, that's it.
Right.
All right? They can pick you up and carry you out of the courtroom and put you on a plane and leave. If you, the alien, want to appeal, you can appeal that decision to the what's called the Board of Immigration Appeals.
Hmm.
That's also within the Justice Department. The judges on that appeals court are employees of the Justice Department. I have heard people say that, well, okay, Garcia got his hearing. And yeah, he admitted he was in the country illegally. But, hey, the judge gave him a waiver on being deported because he was fearful of another gang, a rival gang in El Salvador. Well, all the people saying that don't realize that the attorney general has the right under immigration law to override the Board of Immigration Appeals or a federal immigration judge. Why? Because they work for him, or in this case, for her. Plus, with Mr. Garcia, the gang that the waiver was granted for, it doesn't exist anymore.
Oh, my.
The current president of El Salvador broke it up when he came into office, put all its members in jail, and that gang doesn't exist anymore. So anyone who says Garcia hasn't gotten his due process rights, they obviously don't know the actual details of his case.
Mm. Well, that's very helpful. You speak about this stuff right off the tip of your tongue. What is your background? Today we're talking with Hans von Spakovsky of the Heritage Foundation.
Well, I used to work at the Justice Department, which, as you know, is responsible for handling immigration cases. And I've been working on this issue now for many years at the Heritage Foundation. In fact, the last paper I wrote, your listeners might be interested in, it's about the fact that these, you know, local state judges and local officials who think they're immune.
Yes.
From federal prosecution, if they try to obstruct federal immigration enforcement, they're not immune.
Ah.
They can be prosecuted and they can be put in jail if they hide aliens, they transport illegal aliens, if they try to prevent aliens from being caught and detained by federal officials. They don't have immunity from federal prosecution.
It's very helpful. And you also, as I vaguely recall, you also have been creating a database. This is a little off the subject now. A database at Heritage of actual verifiable election fraud cases. Can you remind me a little bit of what you're doing there?
Sure. We started this a number of years ago. It's our election fraud database. People can easily find it on the Heritage website. It is a database of proven election fraud cases from all over the country. We're about to put another set of new cases up there, and we're going to break down, if you can believe it, 1,600 proven cases of fraud. And by proven, I mean we don't put a case in the database unless somebody's been convicted in a court of law, pled guilty, or a judge, for example, has ordered a new election because of fraud. So we're about to break 1,600 proven cases, and it's an easy to use web page. It's got a map of the U.S. You can click on any state, and it'll pull up all the proven fraud cases in your state with a summary of what happened and citations to the supporting documentation.
So this is something that you could use in testimony and court cases,
yeah,
even.
That's right.
Yeah. Well, this is very helpful. So we got into this discussion today talking about due process with respect to the illegal aliens. And you've pointed out that this is, I don't know if you would call it the scope of due process in these immigration cases is narrower than in criminal cases.
Correct.
Because the deportation is considered a civil and not a criminal proceeding.
That is exactly right.
And okay.
Look, there's even fewer rights for an alien who is caught, for example, within a few miles of the border. You know, if it's one thing if you detain an alien who's been in the middle of the country for a number of years, but aliens who are caught, say, on 5 miles on our side of the border, they can be rejected and returned immediately across the border. I mean, they don't even have the due process, the limited due process rights that other aliens have to have a hearing before an immigration judge.
Yeah. Well, it's very helpful. Any other pieces of advice for those who are working in this area, trying to sort things out like you have? Any pitfalls that are to be avoided or anything you should read? I guess you got your paper there.
Well, I should tell you, Dan, I am working. Heritage is going to publish a paper hopefully soon on explaining to people this the due process rights of aliens and trying to alleviate some of the confusion. I would just say the one big thing, and I see this constantly, is folks in the media particularly believing that the same constitutional rights to which you are entitled to as a defendant when you are criminally prosecuted by the government, well, that must apply to immigration cases, and that's just not the case.
Mm-hmm.
And anyone who thinks that is showing a fundamental ignorance of basic constitutional law.
Well, that's very helpful. Hans von Spakovsky, our friend, thank you so much for joining us today, and may God bless your work.
Well, thank you, and like I said, it's always great to talk to you.
Thanks for joining us for Holding All Things Together. Your gifts to this program help us with future production costs and distribution. If you'd like to support us, our mailing address for your gift is Redeemer Broadcasting, Post Office Box 1520, Olive Bridge, New York, 12461. Thanks.
This week, Jerry West returns to Genesis, where we find Jacob ready to leave his uncle Laban in Haran to return to Canaan, the place God had designated for him and his growing family. There's an impasse between Jacob and Laban. Both note that Laban has prospered under Jacob's management of his flocks, but where Jacob believes he's done his uncle a good turn and now should leave, Uncle Laban fears that his own prosperity will leave with him. The two arrive at a deal, but Laban's deception changes its terms. Jerry is a regular contributor to Holding All Things Together and is a writer for Christian Renewal magazine.
We return this week to our series in Genesis, picking up with Jacob in Genesis 30. The last time we were in Genesis, we saw the discord in Jacob's household between the sisters, both wives of Jacob, Leah and Rachel. Leah, despised by Jacob because she was disguised as Rachel at their wedding, brings forth sons, while Rachel, for the longest time, is barren. But Rachel continues to cry out to God, and God answers her cry, granting her a son, Joseph. It's at this point, with the birth of Joseph, that Jacob aims to leave his uncle Laban and return to Canaan. As noted, there is a symbiotic relationship between the two, but one also of tension, and as we will see, deception. Jacob, essentially an employee of Laban, wants to strike out on his own and extract himself and his house out from under Laban. But more, this is what he was told by God that he would do. Remember that back at Genesis 28, the Lord spoke to Jacob in a dream, telling him that the land on which he lay when he was still in Canaan on his way to Haran would be given to him and his offspring. Behold, I am with you and will keep you wherever you go, the Lord tells Jacob, and will bring you back to this land, for I will not leave you until I have done what I have promised you. Jacob's desire and readiness to leave Mesopotamia and return to Canaan, now with a family and flocks and herds of his own, is of the Lord, indeed part of the Abrahamic covenant. No wonder Jacob feels himself ready to leave. But it won't be easy to disengage himself from Laban. Jacob is forthright with his uncle, but also respectful. "Send me away," he tells Laban. "Give me my wives and my children for whom I have served you, that I may go." Jacob understands his position under Laban and so acknowledges his uncle's prerogative, though he presses Laban for acquiescence. Laban is also respectful, knowing well that his own prosperity is tied to Jacob. He begins his own appeal with the phrase, "If I have found favor in your eyes," acknowledging something special about Jacob, the covenant promise, though without fully understanding it. It's a phrase that implies a request for an extension of kindness or grace. Jacob is in possession of something that Laban is not, and Laban knows it. This is why Uncle Laban tells Jacob, "The Lord has blessed me because of you." What we find is that the two are at an impasse. Laban does not want Jacob to leave because he thinks his own prosperity will leave with him. So he tells Jacob to name his wages, and Laban will pay it. Jacob, on the other hand, reminds Laban of what Laban already well knows, though insists on keeping to his advantage. That is, how his uncle's own house has prospered under Jacob's management. But he mentions this not because he wants to stay, but because he wants to leave. God's blessing is upon Jacob, the covenant heir, and so he has brought tremendous benefit to Laban. He wants his uncle to acknowledge this and let him go. Laban, however, does not relent, telling Jacob again to name his price to stay, which Jacob does. He will separate every spotted or speckled lamb and goat, as well as every black lamb, from the flocks, and they are to be his, to which Laban agrees. We'll see in what follows that both Laban and Jacob deceive each other, though only one comes out on top. We have already considered the deception that marks Jacob, but also his mother, Rebekah, in deceiving Isaac to bless Jacob instead of Esau, and here, too, with Rebekah's brother, Laban. It seems to run in the family. God does not countenance sin in anyone, including his own people, but God's purposes are greater than the sin of his or other people. That is never an excuse to sin, of course, but it does show the sovereignty of God in even the smallest events in history. In Jacob and Laban's case, this seemingly smallest of events results in the fulfillment of God's covenant promise.
Time once again for This Week in History. April 12, 1861. Following the refusal to surrender the fort to the Confederacy, Confederate shore batteries under General P.G.T. Beauregard open fire on Union-held Fort Sumter in South Carolina's Charleston Bay. At least 4,000 shells are fired at the fort over the next 30 hours. Also April 12, 1981, astronauts Robert L. Crippen and John W. Young embark on the maiden flight of the Space Shuttle Columbia, launched from Cape Canaveral, Florida. The first reusable manned spacecraft to travel into space, the Columbia stays aloft for a 54-hour space flight of 36 orbits. April 16, 1881. Famed gunfighter Bartholomew "Bat" Masterson is severely wounded in his final gunfight in Dodge City. He will survive to eventually become a sheriff. And April 17, 1964. Henry Ford II unveils the Ford Mustang at the World's Fair in Flushing Meadows, New York. The original pony car, Ford sells over 400,000 in the first year of production. Over 10 million will be sold over the next 55 years. that was this week in history, events as man recorded them, as God ordained them.
That's our program for this week. Thanks for joining us. Holding All Things Together is a production of Redeemer Broadcasting, and the views expressed are those of the participants. If you'd like to help us continue to produce this program and distribute it to others, please consider supporting us. Our mailing address for your tax-deductible gift is Redeemer Broadcasting, P.O. Box 1520, Olive Bridge, New York, 12461. You may also email us at ministry@redeemerbroadcasting.org. For Holding All Things Together, I'm Dan Elmendorf.
And I'm Calvin Carter.
God willing, see you next week.